Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Helene Olin, author of a new book on the personal financial advice scam. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from economist Heidi Shierholz on what has and hasn't been driving the polarization in wages between the top tiers and everyone else. My first guest is Helene Olin. She's the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry, just out from Penguin's Portfolio imprint. She also blogs for Forbes. Helene Olin. Welcome, Helene. First, tell us how you got into this line of work of being a personal financial pundit.
I became a pundit the old-fashioned way. Someone called me up one day and said, can you write personal finance? Do you know anything about it? And I was 30 years old, and I was a freelance writer, and all I knew about personal finance was that it paid a heck of a lot more than the regular writing I was doing. So, of course, I said yes. And I thought, okay, I'll do one. It was the Los Angeles Times, by the way. They were asking about the money makeover feature. And I thought, I'll do one of these. They will discover I had no idea what I was talking about. I will cash the paycheck for double my usual fee, and we will go our separate ways, and no harm done. So I take the assignment, and I sit down. And the way Money Makeover worked is you coordinate somebody who wrote in looking for advice with a financial planner, and you're there as everything from the referee to guiding the questions. And so I sort of did this, and I began, because I figured I had to justify a paycheck somehow, asking questions about money and this woman's life with money. And at the same time, I bought a copy of Personal Finance for Dummies, and I'm literally jotting down terms that I'm going to look up later so that I actually know what I'm talking about. And I go ahead and write the piece. And the next thing I know is I get a call from the LA Times saying, this is wonderful. Can you write another one? So I'm like, oh, okay, sure. And I did that. And I did another one and another one. And within a few months, somehow, I was mainly writing the feature. And I somehow slowly figured out what I was doing.
And then did you start doubting the wisdom of the experts?
I did. You know, it was funny because what I slowly realized was that my take, the reason I could be a financial expert was because my take was no better or worse than anybody else's. You know, on one hand, a lot of this stuff is very easy to understand. You know, the financial services industry makes a mint by making it very complicated and difficult. And knowing what a mutual fund is just not that hard, right? Knowing that you should just be in an index fund is basically basic advice. But at the same time, of course, nobody knows what a stock is going to do over 6 months or 6 weeks or 6 years or what the markets are going to do over those times. So I would listen and, you know, people would say, housing in Southern California is never coming back. This is 1997, right? Don't buy gold. Don't buy silver. That stuff is, you know, never going to return to what it was in 1980. The stock market always goes up. You know, you're going to be, your 401k is like the little engine that could. Just keep putting money in and you'll be fine. And of course, you know, we all know that hasn't worked out.
I think just about everything you said was false, right?
Everything we said was pretty much false, except for the fact that if you can keep money in the market, it seems like you will do okay over time. But the thing I learned, even when I started to research that, is we're really looking at projections based over a relatively short period of time. And the American stock market is actually quite unique that way. And the reason it's quite unique is because there was these world wars, as we all know, in the middle of the 20th century, and we ended up as one of the few functioning economies for a while. So in fact, the gains in our stock market you don't really see anywhere else with the exception of one or two other countries. As I say in the book, I put it as saying the stock market will go up 8 or 9% a year, which has been true for the past 80 years or so, is sort of like being in Europe in 1913 and saying, gosh, you know, the odds of a continent-wide war are pretty slim. We haven't had one in 100 years. And we all know what happened next. There were two in the next 30. So we're basing a huge assumption on a very short time frame, actually.
This industry exploded with the stock market and the financialization of everything, which really started in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, then really got going in the 90s. But you have a chapter about the first financial guru who is widely forgotten now. Actually, I'm old enough to remember her, Sylvia Porter.
I'm glad to hear you still remember her. Sylvia Porter. What do you want to know about her? How she got started? She was a girl from Long Island, Sarianne Feldman. And her mother was a widow who lost all the family money in a stock market scheme in 1929. And Sylvia was in her early 20s and started doing freelance writing around New York about financial issues. And she gets a column at the New York Post, where, by the way, nobody knows, except for her editors, nobody knows she's a woman. She writes as S.F. Porter for several years. And that she's female doesn't come out until the 1940s. And over time, she's the person who develops the personal finance genre, sort of as this ideal that she is going to teach people how to manage their money so that the Great Depression never occurs again. She sees this very much as an education thing at first.
And continuing a theme that will develop throughout this industry, a lot of people in this line of work seem to think that individuals can really compensate for social and political problems.
Right. I mean, what sort of happens to personal finance, probably in the late 70s, early 80s, is, as I say, it goes, it's at a certain point, it crosses the line from aid into ideology, probably in tandem with the Reagan years. And so it goes from Sylvia Porter's education to Jane Bryant Quinn, who was really, you know, her big rival in the 60s and 70s, who's very much in the consumerist mode of, you know, very muckraking in her personal finance journalism, to somehow going the next level and becoming about, this is how you do it, and if it doesn't work, you must have done it wrong. It really becomes like any other piece of service journalism. You know, you don't make the apricot lamb stew, it doesn't come out right, it's your fault because the burner was too high. And that's the same thing that happens to personal finance journalism. It, after a time, begins to sound like a cross between an Ayn Rand self-determination tract and a Victorian morality tract. Where, you know, you can do it, you're on your own, you can do this, and if you don't do it, you know, you deserve whatever comes to you, basically.
Now, you train your sights on a couple of people who are stars of the field. One is Susie Orman, the ubiquitous Susie Orman. Tell us about her.
Susie Orman, as I put it, she's almost in a strange way, her story's the opposite of Sylvia Porter's. Sylvia Porter comes of age, you know, at a time when her family had made some money and then loses it along with everybody else in the stock market crash. Susie Orman has the exact opposite background story. She comes of age in the 1950s when everybody surrounding her has money or has more money than they used to, but her family can't catch a break. Her dad's chicken shack burns down. He's uninsured. He tries to open a boarding house. A tenant gets injured, as I put it. Apparently, he didn't learn his lesson about insurance. The family has no money when everybody else does. It's tense, and she flees to the West Coast. She takes a job as a waitress and confides one day to one of her regulars that all she really wants to do is open a restaurant. And the regulars love Susie because then, like now, she's quite a compelling figure. And they somehow all together get together $50,000 to help her open this restaurant. Susie takes this to Merrill Lynch, and it's lost within weeks. And when she goes in to complain, they offer her a job. That's how Susie Orman got her start. She shows up on her first day of work, by the way, with a crystal. That's how she determines investments.
It's actually probably no worse than any other techniques.
Yeah, it worked for her, though for the record, she has long lost the crystal, so I don't want it to sound like she has a crystal on TV today. And from there, you know, her insight was that she was going to help the little people who all the brokers, you know, who were desperately on the make, were ignoring, the people like herself, you know, the truck drivers, the waitresses, the phone company employees. And that's where she really gets her start, and she, you know, begins to write books. And her books are sort of steeped, especially the early ones, in this sort of mix of basic financial advice with very much the, you know, 1970s self-actualization movements of the Bay Area. So as people put it with her breakout book, one reviewer actually said, "I've never seen anything like this." So one chapter, you know, would be about the spirituality of your money, and the next one would say, what is a revocable living trust and should you have one? It was a real mishmash, and this really appealed to people.
I've only watched her a couple of times on TV, but she seems to have acquired a nastier streak over time.
Yes, she most certainly has. And, you know, it seems to have come in tandem with the aughts. As the economy worsened, it seems like Susie's attitude worsened. And she became, you know, she's become quite harsh. I joke, she feels like the Jewish mama, tiger mom sometimes. But she really yells at people in a way that I actually don't think she did earlier in her career. And she's become very successful. And I think, like a lot of people who become very successful, she's become increasingly cut off from the day-to-day life her fans lead. The same thing happened to Sylvia Porter, by the way. You know, Sylvia Porter went from somebody who was giving, you know, comfort and advice to people in the heart of the Great Depression to somebody who turned up on television in the mid-1970s dripping with diamonds and suggested people give up their veal for chicken, which was, veal was a very expensive cut of meat at that point. Not too many people ate it. This seems to be an almost inevitable progression of these people. They confuse their trajectory almost, that they made their money giving personal finance advice with the personal finance advice that they're giving, which is two slightly different things.
I'm speaking with Helene Olin, who is the author of Pound Foolish, just out from Portfolio Books. Another character who mixes the American obsession with God and money together in one is Dave Ramsey. What about him?
Oh, Dave's got another story. I mean, one thing about all these gurus, by the way, is they all have a great story. Dave's story is that he was a real estate wheeler-dealer in the 1980s in Tennessee, but it was all built on smoke and mirrors. And, of course, the real estate empire crashes in the late 80s with all the other real estate stuff that crashes. And Dave is forced to declare bankruptcy. The lesson Dave takes away from bankruptcy is that this is a really painful process. And he is going to spread the message that debt is evil and that people should pay down their debts and not declare bankruptcy and live a financially responsible life. So he starts a little radio show in Tennessee in the early 1990s. And a little financial advisory service. And his empire builds up from there. And he spreads the message. He's on 500 radio stations today that you should live a morally righteous and fiscally righteous life. And his message is quite extreme. He does not believe you should have any credit cards at all. He only permits a 15-year mortgage. He counsels people not to declare bankruptcy. Again, this is someone who has declared bankruptcy. And, you know, he tells his followers things like income inequality is a myth, that you can choose not to participate in a recession. And it's really quite unbelievable to me that anybody takes this stuff seriously, but they do. And when I went down, I actually went and saw him speak and went and interviewed people in the audience. And what I found, of course, is they had debt the way most people have debt in the United States in 2012 and 2013. And that is, of course, health care bills, job crises, all the bad events that happened to all too many of us. I say Dave is like a drug pusher who set up selling OxyContin and got addicted to the product he was selling, but doesn't realize that the people he's preaching to got addicted to OxyContin because they were in genuine physical pain, or in this case, financial pain.
Yeah, I wrote a piece about bankruptcy not long ago, and I came across his stuff. And bankruptcy is actually an option a lot of people should consider and they're afraid of. And it really seems criminal to have this character with the influence he does counseling against it, especially someone who's gone through it himself.
Right. I joke, and, you know, I always think, I was like, why didn't somebody just say to him at the beginning, what are you talking about? You declared bankruptcy. But I think people really, there is a real stigma to this day to bankruptcy. And what inevitably happens is people are desperate to avoid it. You know, contrary to the myth of the credit card industry, people are not running up huge bills with the intent of going into bankruptcy court and keeping, you know, their designer clothes and their, you know, Apple iPod smartphones and all the rest. they're a genuine financial pain when they get to this point. And what often happens is people are so desperate to avoid bankruptcy, they clean out their retirement accounts before they get to that point, which is, of course, one of the few things that's actually protected from bankruptcy fully, are your retirement accounts. So this is actually among the worst advice you can give people, and it often really doesn't help them. I mean, I literally spoke to one person who was hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, which started with an ill-timed home renovation, followed by the fact the poor guy was a pilot and his salary got cut, you know, several times post 9/11 to the point where he's now earning what he was in 1991. And he and his wife tried to start a small business to make up the lost income. And, of course, it went belly up the way most small businesses do. And he was there trying to pay down the debt because Dave said it was wrong not to pay down his debt. I mean, I was just floored.
There are quite a number of myths that float around this business, and the popular one is if you just stay away from Starbucks, you can retire a millionaire. What about that?
That's my favorite of all time, I think. And it's one of my favorites in part because it goes back to my money makeover days. I always remember people saying, you know, when they were talking to my people who were having trouble, the financial planners, just, you know, cut out Starbucks. So this was around for a long time in the 90s. And, you know, a guy named David Bach, a money manager for Morgan Stanley, you know, creates an empire preaching this. He writes a book in 1999 called Smart Women Finish Rich. And he says if you give up your daily latte, you can retire with between $1 and $2 million in the bank. And he bases, and it doesn't work on any level whatsoever. Mathematically, it did not work. He was assuming 11% stock market returns, average annual. It didn't work because at the time he was assuming a latte cost $5. It doesn't really even cost that much today. It certainly didn't cost that much in 1999. So he immediately was throwing in other things like a muffin and other discretionary things. And then, of course, the main kicker is that's assuming you could even leave the money there because most people aren't wasting their money on lattes. They're wasting their money on things like health insurance, education, housing, all the things that have gone up at rates well beyond that of inflation for decades. And it was just this simplistic message, but it's a simplistic message we really want to believe.
Yeah, the notion that Americans are profligate, I guess this has something to do with Protestantism and and Dave Ramsey, too. But the notion that Americans are profligate really is just largely mythological, isn't it?
It's almost completely a myth. I mean, you know, there was definitely, you know, a spending, you know, I don't want to say a spending surge. That's not the word I mean. You know, there's definitely a promotion of spending in our culture. There's no question. But as I always say, nobody needs a $1,000 infant stroller, for instance. But the fact is, it's not what's causing our problems. Our problems are being caused by these costs that are going out of control, the things you can't cut back. Good luck to you, you know, trying to cut back on health care. Though people do it, and then they don't take their medications that they need. Good luck to you cutting back on education. If you do that, you know, getting a college degree is one of the few ways to get ahead at this point. That's really not going to work either. And but we don't want to believe it. And, you know, we could talk for hours about why that is. I think it's a very hard thing to challenge the American dream. You know, we believe deeply in the myth of Horatio Alger in this country. As I always say, Horatio Alger was a writer of nonfiction. Of fiction. Horatio Alger wrote fiction, not nonfiction. And it probably wasn't even true then. But it certainly isn't true now. But we don't want to believe it. We really want to think we can all get ahead.
Now, let's step back and look at this, the big picture of this. So we have an industry, a financial industry, in which the advisors and the gurus and the money managers make a lot of money by advising people on what to do or running their money if they get a hold of it. But the average person, the average saver who's just trying to finance a comfortable retirement doesn't do anywhere near as well, right?
No, they don't. And I mean, this is a problem that obviously goes back decades. You know, somebody wrote a book back when entitled, Where Are the Customers' Yachts? The industry makes money win, lose, or draw. You know, they make money with every trade, with every investment. And they've got it very set that way until they make billions of dollars in profits annually. Until last year, in fact, they did not even have to tell you how much they were charging you for the privilege of you putting money in your own 401k. You actually had no legal right to know that information. which is simply astonishing to me. And they had all sorts of reasons as to why, most of which came down to the fact it would be really too complicated to tell our customers this, to which my response is, well, gosh, you know, is it really too complicated to figure out where all the profits are going? You must be paying bills. Surely you can figure out how much you're charging people. It's really something else, and they really have it set so that it's very hard for people to figure out how much they're paying for advice and how much they're actually making.
What should people do? Is there some way that managing your money wisely can make your life better, or is it just beyond the capability of the average individual to do that?
I certainly would never say I'm fully against personal finance, because obviously if things are going well for you, of course it can help you quite a bit. On the micro level, I always say, I still recommend Personal Finance for Dummies, by the way. It's a great book. It's still the least intimidating book out there on the subject I've ever stumbled into. You can live a responsible life. You can read up on this stuff. In terms of getting investment advice, I always ask people, remember the F word, fiduciary. And that means whether the advisor you've gone to has a duty to act in your best interests. The vast majority of advisors work to something called the suitability standard, which is a very loose standard, which basically means they only have to sort of act in your sort of okay interests. It's like if you went to a store and they could just sell you any piece of clothing that vaguely fit, basically, which is indeed what happens to us. But clothing is less important than our financial futures. And by the way, the reason it is this way is because the industry has fought for years to the attempts by the Obama administration to expand the fiduciary standard to cover anybody who gives advice on retirement accounts or brokerages. So that's something you could do on a micro level. On a macro level, I've asked people to really begin to talk about this, because one of the reasons the culture of that we are financially irresponsible and all bad things that happen to us financially are our own fault persists is because we have such a deep culture of shame around this in our country, so that we almost allow people to assume that if we hit financial trouble, it was because we were extravagant and bought too many lattes or succumb to the lure of the $1,000 baby stroller. We don't want to admit, you know, to our healthcare crises that bankrupt us, to the job losses that have caused us to not be able to save money or wipe out our retirement accounts, to the fact that we're among the people whose salaries have stagnated and fallen and made it almost impossible for us to save money. In fact, you know, about half of us live paycheck to paycheck right now, so clearly we're having a massive problem saving money.
And no amount of Dave Ramsey's going to fix that.
No, despite what Dave thinks, you can't choose not to participate in income inequality or a recession, unfortunately. I'm still trying to figure that one out myself, though. If somebody can tell me how, I'm all ears.
That was Helene Olin, author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry, just out from Penguin's Portfolio imprint. She also blogs for Forbes. 2 points of my own. I almost never give personal financial advice, but I'm going to make a brief exception. One, it's almost impossible to beat the markets. Even most of the pros can't do it. Be careful, and remember, it's virtually impossible to invest your way from modesty to riches. And second, if you've got a serious debt problem, then you should consider filing for bankruptcy. The consequences are surprisingly mild, and you can be liberated from a miserable burden. You can't get out of a mortgage or student debt that way, but there are many kinds, like credit card and medical debt, that you can erase with a bankruptcy filing, so look into it if you're in a bad spot. Ignore all the tools of the financial industry who tell you otherwise. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web, kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Some people really need
That was some of For the Love of Money, performed by Defunct. Next up is Heidi Scherholz. Heidi Scherholz is a staff economist with the Economic Policy Institute and one of the co-authors of their biannual State of Working America, a real masterwork of economic truth. She and her colleagues have written a lot on the issue of wage polarization, why the top is doing so well and everyone else isn't, and you can read their stuff on EPI's website, epi.org, epi.org. Heidi Scherholz. Welcome, Heidi. Incomes have been polarizing now for, about 4 decades, and we have a whole variety of explanations have grown up to explain why that's been happening. Let's review, first of all, some of the standard ones. What is the consensus of the economics profession insofar as there is one on why we've seen such a polarization in wage and other forms of income?
If you're asking a labor economist, what they will say in general, I think what a typical academic economist would say is that wage trends are driven by changing demand for workers with different types of skills or different types of workers. And so if you have, for example, all of a sudden workers with higher levels of education being in higher demand, then that will drive up their wages, and then you'll see increased wage inequality. So that's a really prevalent story out there. I think it gets pushed by academic economists because it sort of fits in line with labor supply, labor demand, the typical models that sort of mainstream economists will look at. One of the problems with that explanation is that the timing of those changes in demand for different types of workers doesn't actually match the timing of massive increases in wage inequality. And one of the key things that you could see is that we've had increasing demands for workers with higher levels of education for decades, since far before we started to see big increases in inequality. So that right there says, okay, well, how come in the 50s and 60s, the increasing demand for, say, workers with a college degree didn't drive massive increases in wage inequality, but in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, it did. You know, so it sort of undermines that idea that, all right, it's returns to a college degree that's driving our big wage inequality. So then you start to look to other causes of inequality, and there you see stuff that has more, you know, it fits the data better. So things like, you know, something as simple as the declining real value of the minimum wage. We know that increases inequality. It means workers at the very bottom make less in real terms. And so that spreads apart the wage distribution. Declining unionization rates. We know unions have an equalizing force on the labor market. So when unions decline, that increases inequality. The list goes on and on. There's no one reason. There's a bunch of different choices that have been made that have led to, sort of policy choices that have been made that have led to this increase in wage inequality. I said minimum wage, declining unionization, things like the Federal Reserve Board prioritizing price stability, i.e. low inflation, over full employment. Higher unemployment rates hurt people at the bottom more than they do people at the top. So that increases inequality.
Now, let's step back a bit, though. You mentioned the increasing demand for college-educated workers going back well before the period of rising inequality. But there's kind of a little trick here in that college is used as a substitute for skill, which is very hard to measure. And second, you know, there are also an awful lot of jobs have been de-skilled over time. It used to be, you know, if you go way back, the mechanics of the 19th century, artisans of the 19th century had a tremendous amount of skill, which are then transformed into very routine industrial jobs through Taylorist techniques. So let's talk about the skills here. What exactly do we mean when we talk about skills in the job market?
It's a really good point, and it's constantly evolving, like you said. And labor economists are constantly trying to find a way to a good metric to capture that. It used to be that people would try to capture "quote unquote" skill with education, but you pointed out, you know, it's just not that clear cut. You can't say necessarily that someone with a BA is more skilled than someone without, when you think of highly skilled trades people, bunch of different occupations that don't match up that well. And I use the word occupation intentionally because sort of the latest thing in vogue amongst people who look at this is to actually look at occupations instead of education. To look at detailed occupations and say, okay, if we have occupations that are sort of detailed enough, then that will be capturing some kind of sort of skills basket. So, radiologist has a certain set of skills, and if you identify them as a radiologist, that captures something. And then a plumber has a separate set of skills, and once you identify them as a plumber, that captures something. A secretary has a different kind of skill, the same story. So people have started to say, all right, I can kind of capture this idea of skills by looking at people's occupations. But one thing that I think what you said underscores is even that's not quite, doesn't quite do it if you look over time, because as we know, the skills required to be an administrative assistant are very different now than they were a couple decades ago, when you just think of computerization of scheduling, that sort of thing. So it's not easy to capture. It's an ongoing sort of empirically difficult thing to pin down. But the latest sort of iteration in the research around this is to identify people's skills not by their education, but by the occupations that they're in.
And the changes of the makeup of the labor force or the job market over the last, say, 40 years, what has the contribution been of, or what's the general pattern that we've seen of the changing mix of skills? Are we seeing a growth in low-skilled jobs, medium-skilled, high-skilled? How's it shake out?
That is a very interesting question, and it depends on over what time period you look. So if you look over the entire period from, say, the 70s to the present, what you see is this kind of U shape that in skills that work, that jobs with lower levels of skill have seen employment growth, think kind of service sector jobs. Jobs with very high levels of skill associated with them have seen employment growth, and we've seen this kind of hollowing out of the middle. And that is the pattern that has, if you've heard the term job polarization, that's what it means, that you've seen more growth, relative growth at the bottom, a more hollowing out at the middle, and higher growth at the top. So that's what you see. You actually see it going even farther back. It's even before we had good data, there's good suggestions that kind of U-shaped growth has been happening for a while, if you look over even longer periods. But the interesting thing is, if you break down into smaller, if you look at different business cycles, you don't see that pattern. So if you look at, say, the 80s, you saw job growth not looking like a U, but looking sort of like a straight arrow pointing up, that there was very low skilled, the low-skilled jobs saw job loss, middle skill saw a little bit more growth, and high-skilled jobs saw a lot of growth. If you look at the 90s, you see some of this U-shape. If you look at the 2000s, you see it going the other way. You see the low-skilled jobs seeing some growth, and then this real tapering off where high-skilled jobs are not seeing the growth. So if you look at any individual period, you see vastly different trends. So this idea that we've seen some consistent U-shaped or job polarization over time, it just doesn't hold up when you look at the data. And I think a key thing to note is that it is not true in the 2000s. We have not seen that kind of job polarization since the 90s.
And another favorite explanation of economists is related to this is skills bias technological change, which basically boils down to we need more people who know how to operate computers on the job. How true or untrue is this?
It's a tricky thing to sort of, well, I'm not doing a very good job. It's a tricky thing to sort of pin down succinctly, but it gets at the exact same other things we've been talking about, where if you we're indeed seeing this skill bias technical change, or this the workers who are using computers seeing more returns to their work, you would have seen a big shift in the wage trends right about when computers happen. Like, you should be seeing big changes. And in fact, that timing doesn't actually pan out very well. You don't see that that's a big driver of wage trends, because the timing of those things doesn't match up. And so you sort of have to look for other kinds of explanations, and that's where you end up if you start to look at labor market institutions like declining unionization, declining real value of the minimum wage, increased globalization with the rest of the world. The timing of these other kinds of explanations matches up better with the wage trends that we've seen, and the big increases in inequality in particular since the 70s.
Yeah, I want to return to these institutional questions a little bit, but when these developments enter the political sphere, it gets boiled down to everybody should go to college. That's the way to get a good job and earn a good living. How true is that? Has it become more or less true over time?
It's your point is a really good one, that it sort of is. It seems to be that no matter what people use to diagnose, say, as the cause of increasing wage inequality, their answer always seems to be everyone needs to get a college education. And in fact, it's important to know if lack of college education is indeed driving wage inequality before we say that's the solution. And if you, one of the key pieces of data that you can look at is how have college wages done over time. If you look at people with just a college degree, their wages have been flat since the 2000, since the year 2000. We have seen no growth in the wages of people with just a college degree since 2000. It's just you're not seeing those increasing returns to college. If all of a sudden everyone went out and got a college degree, it would reduce inequality, but not for the reasons that we would like. It would mean college wages would go down even further relative to non-college wages. It wouldn't boost overall wages, because it turns out the main problem in the labor market is not a lack of skills. It's not that people don't have enough education. We do see increasing demand for workers with more skills, more education over time, but our workforce has been becoming more skilled and more educated over time. And those two forces have roughly met, we've roughly met increasing demand for more education and skills with an increasingly more skilled and more educated workforce. You can just see it with massively increasing enrollment rates and college completion. So that is not the key problem. We do see increased demand for workers with more education and skills. The workforce is, by and large, meeting that demand. Vastly accelerating that isn't actually going to solve our wage inequality problem, because our wage inequality problem is being caused by something else.
I'm speaking with Heidi Scherholz, who is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute and one of the co-authors of their biannual State of Working America. And just turning to recent history, the recovery from the recession, which officially ended in middle of 2009, even though it doesn't feel like that to a lot of people, the recovery has been rather weak. Job growth has been pretty slow. We only have regained a little over half the jobs we lost. And unemployment remains quite high. Now, one of the explanations for this, which is very popular in Wall Street, is job skills mismatch. We just don't have the right workers for the jobs. Jobs are out there, we just have the wrong workers. How true is that? And what is driving this really slow recovery in the job market?
This one is actually completely false. It's a huge narrative, sort of in the public discourse. You see it everywhere, that the reason we have persistent high unemployment is because workers don't have the right skills. But if you look at the data, it actually doesn't pan out. You don't see it. You can look at it a bunch of different ways, but one of a key thing to demonstrate how it's not true is that you see elevated unemployment across the board. It's not isolated to any individual sector, any individual occupations or demographic groups. So, for example, you see workers with a college degree and an advanced degree, they have lower unemployment rates than other workers, but their unemployment rates are roughly twice as high as they were before the recession began. Workers across all major occupation categories have unemployment rates that are much higher than they were before the recession began. If you look by industry, you see unemployed workers outnumbering job openings across the board. There's sort of no corner of the labor market where you can look where there's not a massive shortage of jobs and a massive oversupply of workers. So what that spells is that what we've seen here and what we're continuing to see is just this broad-based drop in demand for workers. That's what's driving our unemployment rate, not that we have workers that don't have the right skills. The job openings simply aren't there.
Is the problem that growth is slow? Growth has been slow in the recovery, but is that the problem, or is there also a bit of severance of the relationship between growth and employment?
You know, it's the first one. We call it a jobless recovery, but really it's a growthless recovery, and then the jobless piece of that sort of follows from the growthless piece. We just, not growthless, but our growth rate, the growth in GDP has just been very much slower than what we would need to generate the robust job growth to get us out of this in any reasonable time frame. So that's the underlying factor. It's employers are not seeing their demand for their goods and services pick up in a way that would make them have to hire workers to meet that demand. So that's the key. The demand for goods and services isn't there. So employers don't have to hire more people because they don't need any more people to meet any more demand because the demand is so weak. And so we end up with this really weak demand for workers. And that is the reason why we're just mired in this persistent high unemployment. It's bad out there. We have, you know, the unemployment rate has come down. And so I think that can kind of lead us to believe there's been some improvement. But there really has been very little improvement. If you notice that the unemployment rate, the reason we've seen the declining unemployment rate is not for good reasons. It's not because workers, a larger share of the potential workforce is getting jobs. It's because people are getting so discouraged. They're just dropping out of the labor force or never entering it because job prospects are so weak. That's not the kind of improvement in the unemployment rate that spells improving fundamentals. We just really haven't seen very much of the good kind of improvement in the unemployment rate. It is, you're right, we're, you know, 3.5 years into this recovery, but for the last 3 of those years, we have essentially been treading water. You know, we fell off a cliff, and we've been sort of bumping around at the bottom of that very deep hole with very little improvement. And it's not because U.S. workers don't have the right skills or because they prefer to be on unemployment insurance. It's not for any of those reasons. It's because we just have weak demand for workers related to weak overall demand for goods and services.
And now let's go back to some of those institutional characteristics of the labor market. Most economists, orthodox economists, don't really like to talk about institutions because they're uncomfortably close to politics, I guess. But that doesn't apply to us. So let's talk about some of those institutional problems that are leading to polarization stagnation for much of the labor force. You mentioned some of the problems like unionization, minimum wage. Talk a bit in more detail about these things.
I think you're absolutely right. It's an interesting thing to think about, but the academic profession doesn't, you know, they want to talk about what's going on with labor market dynamics without talking about things related to policy, which certainly cuts off a huge piece of the driving force of things. And so the things that we're talking about now have been hugely influential in sort of compensation dynamics. So the minimum wage is in some ways the most concrete, the most simple. It's right now about 25% below in real terms where it was at its historical peak in the late 60s. That's just an enormous erosion of the purchasing power of the minimum wage. That just means we see the people at the bottom getting far less compensation than they were decades ago, relative to the overall wage distribution. Unionization has a big equalizing effect on wages. We've seen a big decline in unionization, and so the result has been more pulling apart, more wage inequality. Things like deregulation of markets, the globalization agreements that they protect capital owners, but the agreements that pretty much do nothing but expose our low and middle income workers to extremely low paid workers around the globe while protecting the owners. Those kinds of agreements increase inequality. Something that is, you know, it's sort of difficult because I think there are few institutions in the United States that are outside of a sort of lowercase d democratic control more than the Federal Reserve Board, but the choices made by the Federal Reserve have a big impact on inequality. Not right now, they're basically the Federal Reserve's hands are largely tied because interest rates have been hovering around zero. But outside of the Great Recession, in the 30 years leading up to the Great Recession, we saw the Federal Reserve place much more priority on keeping inflation low than they did on keeping unemployment low. And that increases inequality. High levels of unemployment hurt low and middle income people more than do modest levels of inflation. And so the fact that the Fed was leading up to the Great Recession, more and more prioritizing price stability, low inflation, over low unemployment has been one of the key drivers of increased inequality.
Now, we now know from recently released transcripts that the Fed in 2007 didn't think we're on the verge of a very serious recession. They were very wrong about that. But let's, you know, you step back to the late 1990s when labor markets were tight. There was really strong across-the-board wage increases back then, weren't there?
Yes, that was the key thing. Because if you look at the late 90s, what was different then? We had two things, actually. We had strong productivity growth. So that's an important thing to keep in mind, that productivity growth, that's the amount of goods and services produced in an hour on average in our labor market. That's the floor of rising living standards. You know, that's what makes rising living standards over time for people in any economy possible. So you need productivity growth, but for that, the gains from that productivity growth to be able to reach down, to not just get funneled to the top of the distribution, of not just get funneled to people who already have high wages and high incomes, for it to reach low-income people, middle-income people, a key factor is to have tight labor markets going along with that. Tight labor markets shift some of the bargaining power from employers to workers, because your employer knows that you have a lot of good outside options, and so they're going to have to pay substantial wage increases, decent compensation packages in order to keep you. And so tight labor markets are a key factor in making sure that the overall growth of the country actually reaches low and moderate income people. We are obviously not seeing that now, but one period where we really saw it was in the late 90s, and you can just see the impressive effect it had on the data. It was the one small period in the 30 years leading up to the Great Recession where you actually saw substantial wage growth at the bottom of the income distribution. You saw poverty rates falling. It was the one bright spot, and it was due to both strong productivity growth and extremely low unemployment that shifted some of that bargaining power to workers, despite the fact that we didn't have high levels of unionization.
It takes a political dedication to keeping the unemployment rate, or getting the unemployment rate low. It seems like sustained high unemployment is nothing like a political or economic emergency in the minds of the pundit or political class.
As an economist, all I can say is that we continue to be at crisis levels of unemployment. We're not going to see that come down probably this year much, if at all. I mean, we're still facing another 3-4 years of very elevated unemployment. The fact that this is not being addressed as a massive crisis that we need to do everything we can about is stunning. Washington has fully switched. They did it a long time ago towards focusing on the deficit rather than our key problem right now, which is high joblessness. It's absolutely wrongheaded. It will make our country worse off in the future with massive amounts of just wasted productive potential and destroyed lives. And the scarring effect of job loss on families, on children, on communities is just staggering. And the fact that we aren't acknowledging that this is a continuing ongoing crisis and doing everything we can to fight that, it's a stunning failure of policy.
That was Heidi Scherholz of the Economic Policy Institute. You can read her work on their website, epi.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, like the defunct song we heard earlier, another taste of late 1970s, early 1980s New York City. The waning days of my youth, when artists and musicians could live in Soho because it was still cheap and kind of dumpy. This is New York, New York by D.K. Jones. Till next week, bye.